Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast, episode 79, apparently, How Time Flies. This episode is two stories in one, very much like the Robert Rodriguez film Dusk Till Dawn. But in this instance, we'll start by looking at Operation Tiger, the Allied training exercise off the south coast of England that goes disastrously wrong in 1944. And we'll end up with a story of a Sherman tank. It's all connected by a chap called Ken Small. I'm joined by Ken's son Dean to talk us through it. But just a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by listeners like yourself who bask in a philanthropic, satisfying, rosy glow due to being patrons of the podcast. A dollar or so from you goes a long way towards helping me find the time to put the show together. You can find out more at patreon.com/ww2podcast. By becoming a patron, you'll have access to extras that I release, just a little more World War II chat to keep the little grey cells stimulated. So head over to patreon.com/ww2podcast, where you can marvel at a short video of me explaining it all. So, on to the main feature. Dean, thanks for joining me. Whilst we're going to be talking about Exercise Tiger, which took place in April of 1944, the story isn't really just about what had been a largely forgotten exercise, but I guess that's the place to start. So what's the background to Tiger?
Well, basically, the idea was that the Americans needed to practice beach landings. Naturally, you know, the numbers involved, a lot of the army recruits were young, and it was decided that it was essential that they planned live fire exercises. So having done a lot of research, they found Slaps and Sands to be very similar to Utah Beach geographically. So what they did was they said, right, okay, so they evacuated the area. Obviously, this was all done over several months of time. So the local people were told that, you know, they needed to evacuate. So farmers had to evacuate livestock. People had to leave villages that they'd never left before. And so they didn't know why. It was just an order to do. So off they went, and then naturally the Americans arrived, and Exercise Tiger was a practice that was under the umbrella of Overlord. So there were lots of practices that were going to take place over a period of time. And this is obviously in the lead up to D-Day. So these were specifically designed to give some experience to the young troops that were going to assault the German beaches on D-Day.
But this is a huge operation. We're not talking a few hundred men. They evacuated an enormous area. This is a real massive undertaking, isn't it?
It was massive. You know, I mean, Dartmouth. They say that you could actually walk across the estuary without getting your feet wet because it was just full of. Well, LSTs, you know, various landing craft, etc. So it was a massive operation, and of course all of the equipment had to arrive. So this was planned months and months in advance, and so the exercises started. You know, it was obviously there were various different ones. Exercise Tiger was the one that was tragically went wrong, and that was what led my dad to start his journey. You know,
it goes wrong on the it's the first day with the live firing exercises. Am I right in saying that's the?
It's interesting, this, Angus. It's always a little bit of a grey area. There are all sorts of opinions on this. Some people say that lives were lost on the beaches due to friendly fire. Others say practically none. You know, the major loss of life we do know was obviously in Lime Bay when the LST convoy was attacked. And we know that was the major loss of life. The rest of it is kind of difficult to pin down. The figures vary from in the 700s to 1,000, etc. You know, some conspiracy theories say even more. You know, but I prefer very much to go on what we know. There's all sorts of ideas. There's the idea that we had, there was a demarcation line on the beach, and the idea was that no one would go across that line until a certain hour. This was to allow for the bombardment of the beach, which, of course, was recreating what would happen when they assaulted Utah. But apparently there was a communication breakdown. It was decided to change the time of that bombardment by 1 hour. But that time change didn't get through to the troops that were landing on the beach. Now, obviously, we all know that a demarcation line is one thing. But to be sure, with the technology they had then, that no live fire would fall short of that line was unlikely. So if I'm honest, I suspect there were loss of lives on the beach, but not significant, and certainly nothing in comparison with those lives that were lost in the Lime Bay attack.
Now, this is the following day. I mean, it's certainly a good build up to the, you know, the what they're going to face a D-Day. But it's the 28th of April. There's an assault landing scheduled. That's right, isn't it? A convoy T-4 is carrying. So how big is this convoy? What does it consist of?
It was approximately six LSTs. They were in line of stern, the convoy. The idea was to do a figure of eight in Lime Bay. The reason for this was to replicate the amount of time that it would take to cross the channel. Naturally, a lot of the army that were on these LSTs, because they were fully laden with troops and equipment. The idea was to give them an idea of the time at sea required, because the LST ships, were very slow moving. They all gathered in Lime Bay and they were all in convoy. And it was then that the German flotilla of E-boats, four E-boats broke off the convoy of E-boats to go and look, as they were getting quite a lot of radio frequency interference. So they went to have a look, and that's when they discovered the convoy.
Was it a known area for E-boats to patrol, I guess is the way to put it? I mean, in which case, why is there not a screen put out to protect? Because LSTs are landing ship tanks, so they're not these. We're not talking the little Higgins boats. These are large vessels. So why is there not some sort of Royal Navy or American naval presence screening them?
You're right in saying that this was an area that Schnell boats regularly patrolled, but of course, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, approximately. Well, between midnight and two, they were doing the figure of eight. There was meant to be protection provided by the Royal Navy. I believe HMS Scimitar was meant to be there, but she was in dock in Plymouth, apparently needing some minor repair work. And again, you can read up all sorts of things on the internet about it, but she was not present. I believe the only presence was something along the lines of a minesweeper or something, a pretty insignificant vessel. And I guess a lot of it was probably the classic case of, well, what can go wrong? They're not far off the coast. I mean, they were within Lime Bay. And yes, there's no doubt at all that it may not have been on the normal E-boat run, but they came out of Cherbourg, the E-boat flotilla, and they were regularly patrolling the channel. So obviously, if they feel that there's a possibility of finding the enemy, they are going to wander off, which of course is what they did. And they very quickly identified the vessels, bearing in mind, obviously, not having a clue why they're there or what's going on. They had no idea that they were fully laden with men and equipment. And attacked, and of course they were a very efficient machine, and so in a matter of 15 or 20 minutes, it was total devastation.
So I mean, they're sort of, I guess, the British version of the torpedo boat, aren't they? They fast attack boats. So when the convoy comes under attack, does it have anything that it can actually fire back with? I mean, is there even a way, a protocol for them to defend themselves? Or is it all over before they can even react?
You know, I think the best way to describe it on the night from the LST's point of view is chaos and confusion. The Royal Navy and the American Navy have a completely different way of reacting to an attack. Now, I've heard accounts from survivors of Exercise Tiger of what happened on that night, and it is chilling. You know, it is unbelievable, and it is true that through the confusion, the LSTs are very poorly armed. They shot in the direction of the white wakes that they could see. I believe, you know, one LST actually strafed the deck of the LST behind it. As this happened, yeah, it really was chaos. But no, they scattered. Yeah, I mean, they basically scattered. And of course, we know now that the E-boats had long gone. Yeah, I mean, this was exactly how they worked. They would assess the target, and what they actually did, and probably some expert will correct me, but what they would do is they would approach the target at reasonable speed. Not at full speed, at reasonable speed. Then they would launch the torpedoes. Then they would turn and then leave at full speed. Now, but the problem with the Schnellboot was that it used a huge amount of fuel. I mean, it was basically a boat that was full of engine and fuel. And so they had very limited time. And I'm sure that that they would have probably have returned, but perhaps they were unable to. And we do know from survivors' accounts as well, and actually from the records from the captains of the Schnellboats, that the initial torpedoes that were launched at the convoy, they were actually set at an incorrect depth. So we have survivors' accounts where one American survivor was on the deck of one of the LSTs, and he says that he remembers this incredible scraping noise. We now figure, because they were subsequently about 5 or 6 minutes later hit by a torpedo, that was almost certainly a torpedo that actually just literally skimmed underneath the LST, because they did have a very shallow draft, because they were fundamentally designed to approach a beach.
Two are sunk. Now, so that's a lot of men in the water, presumably with a large convoy with it scattered in a relatively known small area. That shouldn't be a great problem to pick them all up.
Unfortunately, in the chaos that happened, they all scattered. The LSTs all scattered. And they were all told not to return. Not to return to pick up survivors. LST 515, skippered by, I think, Captain Doyle, he disobeyed orders and he went back to pick up bodies. And I believe somewhere approaching around about between 100 and 120 men, the LST 515 picked from the sea. And in effect, he was subsequently court-martialed. For disobeying orders, because of course at the time that they probably felt that by him returning to the scene that he risked the ship and the life of everyone on board, etc. You know, but this was chaos, and I think that, you know, now we've got a situation where it's approximately 2 a.m. in the morning. There are lots of men in the sea. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of fuel burning on the surface. You've got a situation where a lot of the soldiers, sadly, were wearing their life jackets in the wrong position. You know, they were either not instructed or poorly instructed as to how to wear the life jackets. They weren't used to them, so many of them tied them around their waist, because, of course, if they were wearing a backpack, you know, that was the obvious place to put it. So when they went into the sea, they toppled forward. So then you know that they drowned. I sometimes try and imagine what it must have been like on that night. And to be fair, I can't, you know, I can't imagine what it would have been like. You know, you know that you're not in theory about to go into a battle situation. You know, but then all of a sudden you're thrown into it. Some of the survivors even believed when they saw that the first LST hit that they thought they thought it was all part of the exercise.
Well, it's understandable. They were told it's an exercise. If they're all green and they've not seen the war, you don't know what to expect.
No, exactly. They just thought we're going out to sea for a bit of a ride, and then of course the plan was that in the early hours of the morning, convoy T4 would then head towards Slapton Sands and they would continue with the practice landings on the live fire beach.
And the funny thing that surprised me was the fact that it's hypothermia that gets a lot of these guys. It's silly, really, because anybody who's been on holiday in England will realize, in Britain, will realize how cold the sea can be. But for some reason, you think hypothermia is, or something to me anyway, something that's what happens when a ship goes down in the Atlantic, not off the south coast of England.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that surprised me as well. I have heard figures of, how long a fit and healthy male could survive in the seawaters, because it's a temperature-related thing, naturally. And I was quite surprised. And it does vary, of course. I think also that when they're in the sea, I mean, it was at a time of year when the sea would be at its coldest. I mean, the summer warms the sea temperature up fairly significantly, and that tends to stay, right the way through through autumn, etc. So it was the worst time of year, certainly. But of course, they were in the sea a long time. Some of them for several hours. But I do agree. I was surprised to hear that was the case. Although I do feel sure. That a lot of the men sadly would probably have passed away through drowning.
Yeah, we're talking about 750, which is 750 to die on an exercise is a large amount to die. I mean, it might be different if it was D-Day itself, but 750 is a lot of people to go.
The official figures for loss of life, Army and Navy, on that night, the attack in Lyme Bay is 639. That's official and confirmed, every single one. And then the various figures that we then have that are higher than that, they generally include losses during other exercises, live fire, etc., etc. I mean, I personally have never seen any official documentation that absolutely 100% shows the exact number of those who were lost. But certainly on that night, the official figure is 639 American Army and Navy.
The thing is, it's not quite as simple, is it? Because these are held in the utmost secrecy, or as secret as you can make them. So the loss of life has other ramifications for D-Day, doesn't it? Potentially could have cancelled D-Day.
Yeah. Now, this is something which, I hope that I shall get this right. I'm fairly confident. During the exercise, there were a group of people. Numbers vary, but I believe around a dozen people. They were classed as bigot officers. And the... Which is the strangest description, but apparently what these officers had was on them details of the D-Day landings. How specific they were, I have no idea. Whether it was a specific day or time, because we know that the day did, leading up to exercise to D-Day, the day did vary. But this was a real concern because, of course, if any of these officers' bodies had been recovered by German boats and this information had got out, then it was a real worry. I'm told that all of these officers were accounted for, which is incredible, really. And I guess, I suppose, in some ways, we're fortunate in so much that all those years ago, communications and tracking skills, and they weren't available. So, I mean, normally, can you imagine today, an exercise like that could never take place without, everyone knowing about it. It just couldn't have happened. So I think that the secrecy aspect was of real concern, and indeed, everyone who survived Exercise Tiger were told under threat of court-martial never to speak of it again, not even amongst themselves. You know, I've been privileged to meet veterans of Exercise Tiger who have visited the memorial site in Torcross and have actually told their story of that night for the very first time, you know, having not even told their wives and families. I bet today there are veterans of Exercise Tiger. I mean, they're, bless them, you know, they're all now in pretty well in their 90s. And one recently had his 100th birthday. And I bet there's some around now that probably still haven't.
It makes you wonder, was it an official cover-up at the time, or were they just sort of a temporary cover-up, and as it's sort of been allowed to be forgotten rather than made unsecret or anything, it was sort of, we moved on, other things.
I think that what they did at the time was what they needed to do. They needed to keep it secret. I guess from a personal point of view, and it's only my opinion, you know, I think that probably where it went slightly wrong was when they didn't kind of come clean, you know, after the war was over, etc. This is particularly poignant for the family members. You know, they had no idea where their loved ones were lost. And it's no good an individual saying, well, you know, does it matter? It does matter. You know, the Sherman tank that forms part of the memorial that my dad created is a poignant place. It's a place where people can go and think of their loved ones. You know, it isn't in Lyme Bay. You know, we know that. You know, the Sherman tank, of course, was lost off Stamford.
Before we get ahead of ourselves to the tank, because we haven't told the story of how we even get to the tank, because otherwise we've got to the end before we've got to the...
Every good story should have a beginning, middle and end.
It does. So this brings us to your father, Ken Small, who becomes interested in the events at Lyme Bay, which I presume even at Lyme Bay must have been relatively forgotten because the residents weren't even there to witness it. So how does he become interested in events that night?
Well, it was a kind of a strange process, really. My dad had moved from Grimsby, where we lived, to Devon, and he bought a guest house. He sold some businesses that he had, hairdressing businesses in Grimsby. He wanted the good life, you know, he wanted to get out of the rat race and relax. You know, he wanted to stop wearing a suit and tie and put on a pair of calf jeans and do what we all dream of. So he gave it all up and he moved to Devon and bought Cove House, a guest house. And for some unexplained reason, we none of us know why, my dad suffered a mini nervous breakdown. And he didn't want to go out. You know, he just was really struggling. And a very good friend of his, a local fisherman called Tony Steer, he said to my dad, come on, Ken, you've got to get out of the house. This is crazy. And he said, I'll tell you what, you know, why don't you just walk up and down the length of Slapton Sand? You walk up and down the beach, get some fresh air. And he mentioned to my dad that you could sometimes find stuff on the beach. And he thought, oh, well, so my dad did that. He just started walking up and down. And in certain tidal conditions, in certain conditions, you can find artifacts and stuff on the beach. I mean, my dad found bits of shrapnel, which he didn't even know what they were at first. But I mean, a lot, you know, bucketfuls of shrapnel, tunic buttons, parts of rings, spoons, forks, bits of them, you know, bracelets, all sorts of things, and of course coins, you know, and so he thought this is fascinating. And then he started talking more about why it would be there, because of course a lot of this shrapnel and the bullet heads and the ammunition cases didn't make sense. And this is when he heard about the fact that the area was evacuated and something went on. So he spoke to Tony Steer about it, and Tony said about something that was in the bay, on the seabed, that the local fishermen would often snag their nets on. And my dad said, well, what is it? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, well, don't you want to know? He said, well, not really. He said, we just don't go there. So my dad persisted because my dad couldn't swim. And Tony Steer, his good friend, could dive. You know, he had a license to dive. So he went down and my dad went out with him in a boat. Tony dived down. He came back and he said, it's a tank. And my dad said, what do you mean a tank? A water tank, an oil tank? He said, no, it's like an army tank. And I mean, they couldn't believe it. And I mean, from that moment on, my dad was just, I think he was just overcome with fascination. And it was almost as though all of his problems, whatever it was that created him to struggle at that time, just lifted. And he focused all of his efforts on finding out more. And then it went from that to, well, I'm going to recover the tank. And it just snowballed. There was no master plan. Yeah, there was never, oh, well, it's obvious, you know, I'm going to recover the tank, create a memorial and so on. It was never that.
So can you just drag a tank out? Yeah, if you found it off the shore, can you drag it in and go, well, I've found it, it's mine?
Yeah, it's not quite so simple as that. So basically, in order for him to recover the tank, he first had to own it. And it was still owned by the American government. So the first thing he had to do was buy it. That took years. And when I say it took years, you know, it's because you're dealing with bureaucracy, of course. Now, more importantly, what a lot of people today don't realise is that when my dad was initially making inquiries about how do you buy a Sherman tank, because there isn't a book, you know, book published on the subject, he was dealing initially with America. There was no internet. There was a big time difference. Phone calls were incredibly expensive. I think I can remember that when my dad was calling the States a lot, it was more than £1 a minute. And this was in, or this would be, well, in the 70s. And you know, I mean, I can remember quarterly phone bills then of hundreds of pounds. So eventually, after a lot of work, you know, sometimes, you know, they had a business to run. You know, they were busy people. So sometimes, you know, he would have to stop his inquiries and just, you know, do his job of running a guest house and a successful guest house. And then eventually he managed to buy the tank. There were conditions, of course, attached, you know, to the purchase of it. But he eventually managed to buy the tank for, I believe, $50. He actually offered $1, but they suggested that $50 would cover the paperwork and the administration costs. So that was, that stage was over. He now owned the tank. And then again, you know, some years passed before he started the process of recovering it.
Once you own the tank, how do you, I mean, can you just drag it ashore? How do you, I mean, or do you have to build like the Mary Rose that we all watched as kids and sort of get floated up and yeah, everyone stood with bated breath as one of the hoses, wherever it goes, the big bang.
Yeah. You know, it was a massive undertaking. You know, there were all sorts of theories, obviously. I mean, what in the end he did was...
Had anyone done anything similar? Had anyone...
Well, not that I'm aware of. And that's, I think, what caused the problems. He paid for a ship from, I believe, Fort Bovisan in Plymouth. It's a commercial diving centre, a school, if you like. And what he came to an arrangement with them whereby he would pay them and some of their divers, some that were in training and some obviously highly skilled, would dive down. And the idea was to put large straps under the tank, attach those straps to large flotation bags, and then help to give the tank buoyancy. You know, it wasn't to lift it, obviously, to the surface. That wouldn't work with an object like that. It was to give it a degree of buoyancy, and then it could be slowly towed towards the shore. But, you know, there were lots of problems. Yeah, the initial airbags that were provided by a specialist company, they weren't big enough to do the job. So there were lots of holdups and delays. But eventually, you know, the tank made its way to the shore. And, you know, there are some great, you know, I mean, they're my most sort of treasured possessions in many ways. You know, some great photographs in the press of my dad standing on top of the tank, black and white photographs of him standing on top of the tank with this beaming smile on his face, you know. It's just magical. And I have another photograph, a similar one of that, taken at another angle, which shows my mum in a little inflatable boat behind the tank, and she has this great smile on her face. And I, you know, because I'm probably digressing a little bit, but I always like to explain that my mum was an amazing woman. You know, I mean, how many women would agree for their husbands to literally pretty well bankrupt themselves to raise a Sherman tank from the seabed? And she just said, look, Ken, if that's what you want to do, do it. You know, which was amazing. So it was an incredible moment for Dad. And again, another stage in the story. So now he's recovered the tank. Of course, the idea already has been to create this memorial site. Our local council, Southams District Council at the time, were very, very supportive. And they provided the site it now stands on. The land is owned by the Whitley Trust. They were happy for it to be done. And now the site is as we see it today. But the most amazing thing was that once it got to the shore, it then had to be got. We had to get it up the beach. Now, there's a concrete slipway at the end of the beach. So they used a system of pulleys and supports using heavy plant machinery. So there was a lorry with a huge winch on the back of it. Now, that was parked in the car park where the tank sits now. But the cable from this winch had to go across the A379, the main road. So whenever a winching session would start, the cars had to be stopped. So this went on for quite some time. Now, the problem was that the tank weighed approximately 35 tons because it had a lot of silt in it, etc. So as it was being pulled up the beach, it created like a bow wave of shingle, which, of course, made it even more difficult. So eventually, through perseverance and the hard work of a wonderful man called Jim Perrott, a good friend of my dad's and an engineer at the time, they managed to get it up to the concrete slipway. Now they're concerned about other things, because now they're on a solid surface, not like the shingle. And they're thinking, well, what's going to happen now? So they attached a big steel cable to a bulldozer, and they started to pull the tank up this concrete slipway. And to everyone's amazement, the tracks started to turn. We just couldn't believe it. I mean, after probably, no more than maybe 30 or 40 feet, the tank was moving really freely on its tracks. In fact, it was moving so freely that when they pushed the tank across the road, the land starts to fall slightly downhill. They actually had to use the bulldozer to stop the tank from running away. And when it was placed onto the ground where it stands now, it's actually at a slightly rear end down, facing the sea. They actually had to weld the track shut, because otherwise it would just run backwards. And I mean, that is incredible.
I wonder if that's because they must have packed them with grease and things, and it, because it hadn't actually done a lot of driving after packed with grease for being in the water, you broke the seals on the grease and off it went.
Yeah, I think
amazing.
I think that you're exactly right. You know, I mean, yeah, if it moves, either grease it or paint it. You know, that's the theory, isn't it? And I think that it was the crustacea and everything that had grown onto the tank. I mean, there were, I think from memory, about 7 or 8 large conger eels that had it as a home, you know. And I think that when it got to the hard concrete, the weight of the tank obviously forcing down on the tracks, it just started to turn. Even today, even after the years and years that it's been out of the sea, the actual wheels of the tank, obviously the wheels are steel, but they do have a rubber band around them, and you can still see all the markings, you know, Goodyear. You know, I mean, you can still see it. I mean, the rubber of the wheels is just as good, I reckon, as it was probably the day it was made. Yeah, I mean, the other parts of the tank, you know, in particular, actually, the tracks, they're the parts that are showing the worst corrosion because, of course, they're more intricate.
I think it's amazing that your father decides to, you know, pull it out and then gives it away essentially as a memorial rather than keep what was probably a very valuable piece of kit. But how do you? Oh, just tell us about him dedicating it, because that in itself is just jaw dropping. He is such a tenacious man.
Well, so there it was. You know, it's now in pride of place. And so the first thing he does is he thinks, okay, you know, 639 American Army and Navy servicemen lost their lives. It's significant. It's you know, it's a major catastrophe, and so he starts to approach the American Army, because what he wants to do is to honor them. And so his wish is for the American government to provide an officially dedicated memorial to those who lost their lives. And he was helped by a very good friend of his, or she became a very good friend of his, Beverly Byron, congresswoman. And of course, it was passed through the system. And eventually the memorial was officially dedicated, which stands there today. And then when that happened, then my dad thought, well, hang on, you know, this is all really good. I'm pleased that now at last the authorities are beginning to, you know, to acknowledge and exercise Tiger, and as he found more and more out about exercise Tiger, then he said to the Navy, look, you know, what about you? And so then eventually the Navy did the same. And the key thing here is that I think this was the turning point. When the tank was recovered, it was broadcast by, you know, I believe, you know, NBC, ABC, you know, American media were there, and as obviously were British media and foreign media. And this was shown in the States. And then subsequently, some people in the States would get to hear about it, and some veterans started to come forward, because a lot of these veterans, remember going back, had been sworn to secrecy. And even the ones that did speak of it, Often they were completely ignored, because most people's opinion was, hang on a minute, yeah, I've never heard of that. That can't be right. 639 men losing their life, we'd all know about that. So this is when the truth started to uncover of Exercise Tiger. And I think that this is when the authorities quite rightly realised that this was something that they would have to come clean on, and eventually, of course, you know, like you probably know, Angus, more about it than me. There is a period of time when documents are made publicly aware, etc. And I mean, now, of course, yes, you can Google Exercise Tiger, etc. And there's a mine of information, and you know, our website is a great resource for that information, but then it was really sketchy.
I have a memory at some point, of probably 20, 30 years ago, of reading about it. And it was a big thing. I can't quite tie it up, but it'd be sometime, I think, in the late 80s. And it was the newly rediscovered documents and talking about Slapton Sands. So that's why I was aware of it. So I wonder if it all sort of came out, if unbeknownst to me, your father had got the ball rolling and it somehow had turned up in my dad's newspaper, and he went, oh, have you seen this? Ooh.
Sure. I mean, very much. It was covered massively. And of course, then, I mean, all sorts of odd circumstances happened. It turns out that, you know, prior to my dad recovering the tank, he met a veteran of Exercise Tiger who now lived in Plymouth, and around 25 miles away. He came over. His account is in my dad's book, Manny Rubin. He came over, survived Exercise Tiger, then D-Day, and then he came back to England to be with the woman he had met while he was over here. And they married, and they had a business in Plymouth. And when he heard about the tank and my dad wanting to recover it, he came to see my dad, and talked to him at length about his experience on that night. And he actually did initially, you know, he said to my dad, look, you know, Ken, please don't recover this tank. You know, it's a war grave. And of course, you know, my dad was very respectful of this. And one of the conditions of the sale was that he would have to ensure that there were no human remains on the tank, which I'm pleased to say they weren't. I mean, you know, my dad met the driver of the tank.
Well, that brings, did he manage to track down what happened then? I mean, how does the tank get there?
Yeah, I mean, Oris Johnson, the driver of the tank, you know, he explained that it was a 5-man crew. They were basically driving off the ship to drive towards the beach. This is on Exercise Tiger.
Yeah, but it's a DD tank with the canvas sides.
Yeah, a duplex drive tank, so an amphibianized tank. And, you know, he said they were pretty good, but, you know, really they were more designed for river and lake crossings. They were fine in the sea, but not in poor conditions. The conditions were reasonable, but what had happened is an inspection cover underneath the tank had been taken off to service the tank. Now, on a normal Sherman tank, that inspection cover has ventilation slots in it to help cooling. But on the amphibianized ones, the duplex drive tank, of course, it was a solid plate and it was sealed, but the plate hadn't been replaced. I mean, probably like, you know, memory thing, you know, probably just, you know, a guy servicing the engine, a momentary thing of not thinking and thinking, well, hey, you know, it doesn't matter if we don't put this plate back on because it's just there for ventilation. So it was an error. And so when they drove off, almost instantly the tank started to sink. And so they all got off fine. Yeah, so that was, you know, that was good news, obviously. But yeah, it was interesting for Dad to meet Oris Johnson. And then subsequently he started to meet all sorts of people, naturally veterans families, but also a guy, Dr. Ekstrom, who he was a doctor at the time of Exercise Tiger, and he actually treated many of the injured, and he became fascinated with the whole subject, and he did extensive research. But this was all, you know, over a period of years, and my dad was in touch with him, and he received many documents from Dr. Ekstrom about Exercise Tiger, as much as he was able to discover. And I mean, they included letters from Günther Rahl, who was the German skipper of S-130, one of the E-boats that attacked the T-4 convoy. And this letter is Günther Rahl's account of that night, not the official log, which I believe is probably accessible, his account. And it's a very moving thing. You know, this is a man who realized, of course, years perhaps afterwards, that, you know, that the attack led to such a huge loss of life, and that they, of course, were doing their job. You know, I mean, I never forget the moment when we took a group of Exercise Tiger veterans to actually visit the S-130 that's being restored in a hangar in Plymouth, at Plymouth Docks. And the media were there, and we were going to walk into this hangar, and these four American veterans were about to see one of the boats that attacked and sunk them. Yeah. And we just didn't know what was going to be. I was quite concerned, and they walked in and they were incredible. They just looked at it in awe. And one of them said, "Gee, we never stood a chance." They couldn't believe the size of it. And I was completely amazed by their reaction. And when they were interviewed by the media, you know, next to the S-130, it was incredible. You know, they literally said those words. They said, look, you know, these guys were doing their job. You know, we would have done the same thing. And this always amazes me with everyone that I meet that experienced that horrendous night, is the way that they're so almost forgiving of it. So yeah, it is an incredible story, and I mean, it still goes on today. I mean, my dad, it was his life. I mean, it really was his life. You know, he sat next to the tank in his car every single day of the year except Christmas Day. And that was from early morning till dark. You know, he even had his post delivered there. It was his life. And I do think that it was kind of what was meant to be for my dad. He was obviously maybe looking for something, and this was it. This was the thing which was going to be his life. And I'm very proud of what he did, you know, what he managed to achieve, because I am 100% convinced that if you had even attempted to do what he did then today, you'd never do it. Yeah, I mean, health and safety alone would probably stop you, you know. And I think, it is a great thing that he's done, and hopefully, you know, in the coming years, you know, I can do my tiny little bit to ensure that the tank stays there, and you know, we have the Royal Tank Regiment organise and hold an annual memorial service at the tank every year, and we'll continue to do that and pay respects for those who lost their lives, and you know, with a bit of luck, you know, we'll be able to keep the tank there for as long as possible.
Well, there's, you know, the big thing, so there's no reason it should rot away. But so, you know, finally, it's the 75th anniversary, April 2019, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, April the 28th, 2019. And now we always hold the service on the nearest Sunday to the 28th of April. Well, of course, in 2019, the 75th, it is Sunday the 28th of April, which is wonderful.
So have you got anything, is there anything big planned? Have you got
we're hoping to do is, I mean, we're very lucky, really. I mean, very privileged, honoured to have been contacted by several people who wish to attend. So we know that there will be a contingent from France coming over. I believe the mayor of Utah and other dignitaries, along with French media, they wish to pay their respects, which is wonderful. You know, I've been contacted by the American Embassy in London. They wish to send some people. We can't say too much at the moment because obviously things have to be confirmed, etc. You know, we've got the Royal Navy. They've approached us. They want to help us to plan and organise the event. So it's great. You know, I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. There's a lot to do, but hopefully, you know, it'll, as always, work out fine. I've always preferred the services there to be, you know, relatively short, poignant and heartfelt. You know, it is outside, it's in April. You know, we've had everything from horrendous wind and rain to beautiful blue sky, but it can be cold and wet. So we decided that it was best to do it by the tank. So the memorial service itself probably only lasts maybe about 20-25 minutes. But this year, we're certainly going to be having an American serviceman bugler playing taps and a British serviceman in uniform playing the last post, and anything else that we feel will fit in correctly with the service.
It's lovely that they've remembered. You're not chasing, you know, your father was chasing them, you know, in the 70s and 80s. They're remembering. So if anyone wants to see the tank,
yeah,
where can they find it?
Right, well, we have a great website which they can get to, www.exercisetiger.com. That will link to our website where they can learn all about, they can see survivors accounts, they can learn more about the memorial service, the 75th memorial service, and also contact myself or Laurie Bolton. Laurie Bolton is a wonderful lady who has been incredibly helpful to me over the years. She lost an uncle during Exercise Tiger. He went down on LST 531. His body was never recovered, Louis Bolton. And she never met him. Bizarrely, they have the same birthday, but he died 5 years before she was born. And she comes over from the States every year to the memorial service. And she has on several occasions brought groups of Exercise Tiger veterans and their families over. So she is the contact in America. She is still in contact today with some of the veterans and their families.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Dean, let's leave it there. I think at the start, I forgot to mention Dean's father's book. It's The Forgotten Dead by Ken Small. It sold something like a gazillion copies since 1988, and for good reason. I'll put a link on the website if you're interested in picking up a copy. If you're still listening, I have a surprise for you this month. I've finally managed to get on top of things and have a bonus episode for release. If you recall, last year I talked to Gabrielle MacDonald Rothwell about Diana Rowden. Whilst talking to Gabrielle, I discovered her husband, Jeffrey Rothwell, was a pilot for SOE during the war. Sadly, Jeff has subsequently passed away, but I caught up with Gabrielle to talk to her about Jeff's incredible career in the RAF. So look out for that before the end of November. Well, that's all for now. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad heard only in Canada. Reach great Canadian listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Libsyn Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a pre-produced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Email Bob at Libsyn.com to learn more. That's Bob at Libsyn.com.